If you can't replicate it, then you have to be more creative about how you assemble the pieces to say what's the overall uncertainty in the budget. The biggest uncertainty is not the forest carbon per unit area calculation. It's how much forest is there. I'm hoping that they're learning about being interested in mistakes and how we learn from mistakes, and that if you don't acknowledge a mistake, you're not going to get where you want to be. Perceptions of race in our culture have changed a lot over my lifetime, and I think are changing increasingly rapidly.
Hello, this is Joni Mahoney, president at SUNY ESF, back with another Campus Conversation, the podcast. And today, very happy to be welcoming as our guest, Dr. Ruth Yanai, a professor in sustainable resources management and member of the search committee that landed me here. I will be forever grateful because, as I was just saying, I feel like the luckiest person, not the least of which reason is because I get to do these podcasts. The fact that there's this incredible work that is done at ESF, but then I can ask people to stop and tell us about it. So what a fascinating job I have ended up with. And this is the latest installment of faculty members doing really interesting work. So welcome.
You were just talking about reflection. Like, how often do faculty members even think about what the outside world would want to know about it? If our audience is our students and the scientists who read journal articles, we may not be very aware of what the outside world would want to know.
And I will say, especially these days, the outside world has caught up with the mission of ESF. You know, we've been here doing this environmental science and forestry work since 1911 and understanding our impacts on nature and then that impact back on us. And it's just taken a long time to get the outside world to see what, unfortunately, we're seeing now with 1,000-year storms happening 2 years in a row, these hurricanes and wildfires and droughts. And, you know, the work that you're doing and that your colleagues do here at ESF applied is going to be the solution that saves all of us. So I think people are a lot more interested than you might guess.
I want to speak to that change. So even among environmental scientists, when I started my PhD, which was in 1983, working at Hubbard Brook Experimental Forest, the goal was to describe the undisturbed forest and compare it to the one we were clear cutting. And I believed it, and that was normal. And we were looking for these like pristine sites where we were studying nature. And nobody would say that now. And we would look back and say, 1983, that wasn't undisturbed nature. What were CO2 concentrations in 1983? You know, we had acid rain, we had ozone, we have people out there manipulating the forest and everything. So the goals of our study of nature have changed.
So let's start at the beginning with you. What was your path here to ESF? Where did you grow up?
Oh, my mother was an environmentalist in South Jersey, and my father was an analytical chemist. And if you cross an environmentalist with a chemist, you get
you meet a biogeochemist
who studies forests.
That's cool. I mean, your mother had to be way ahead of her time as an environmentalist. So you must have had a very interesting household to grow up in.
Yes. She was hopping streams and we were floating down the Wading River and we camped and stuff like that.
And then where did you head off to school originally?
International perspectives are important to me. My father's Japanese. I had visited Japan. But 1976, when I graduated from high school, we weren't like we are now. And when I spent a year in France as an exchange student, we didn't have the internet. You didn't call home. That was hyper expensive. You do that once at Christmas. Partway through college, when I wasn't sure what I was doing, I dropped out and hitchhiked around Europe and could not get an illegal job in France. I got an illegal job in England working for the Youth Hostel Association, which doesn't seem like it'd be hiring illegal aliens.
No.
In the Lake District. So that was an exposure to nature and ecology. So when I got back to college, where I had declared a major in physics and philosophy, because you only had to do half of each, and I was interested in everything, including writing, I took Herb Borman and Tom Sikkema's class at the Yale Forestry School on terrestrial ecology, and I took an intro geology course.
That was the spark?
Well, and I was introduced to Hubbard Brook, which is this important research site that I then eventually, after a couple years after college, went back to do my PhD at, under the direction of Herb Borman at Yale.
And this is in New Hampshire?
Yeah, the research sites are in New Hampshire. Not very convenient to New Haven, Connecticut. Not very convenient to Syracuse, New York. The reason it's there is because the land wasn't valuable for something else, so it had remained forested. And the Forest Service set it up initially to study hydrology. And Herb Borman in the 1960s, with the advent of the auto analyzer and the plastic bottle, if we collect rainwater and analyze it, and stream water and analyze it, and they have hydrologic budgets, we can multiply and calculate nutrient input-output budgets. So they discovered acid rain.
And so that spark has stuck with you.
That connection to that place has stuck with me, which I've gone back and forth in terms of having funding to work there. But now it's the focus of my on-the-ground forest ecology research is New Hampshire. Hubbard Brook is one of three sites in which we have nitrogen and phosphorus fertilization experiments of 13 forested stands.
I read that you have one of the longest term data sets.
There are many such experiments in the world. One of the most famous is in Hawaii. There's one in Panama. They're in the tropics. I know of one in Alaska. There were none in temperate forests. So this is the longest running NYP factorial fertilization experiment in a temperate forest anywhere in the world. If you qualify it enough, you can be the
we
only
can get
one
to Ruthie
of
and
anything.
I. Okay.
Yeah.
So what exactly is nitrogen and phosphorus fertilization? So you're adding nutrients and then studying the effect?
The reason we're adding nutrients is to study how forests respond really to nutrient limitation. Plants, forests, ecosystems require elements in different amounts. We require nutrients in different amounts, and we're trying to balance that all the time with how we choose what we eat. So what does a plant do if it needs more nitrogen? What does a plant do if it needs more phosphorus? And we can disturb that balance by adding one or the other. So we're interested in the mechanisms by which plants and ecosystems adjust to resource limitation or resource balance.
So it's a limitation rather than too much?
Yeah, we're not adding enough to be too much. We knew that at the Harvard Forest, when they added 150 kilograms per hectare per year of nitrogen, they killed the trees. So they're low levels, and we see lots of things that are happening in response to those, but they're low levels of perturbation.
How would you tell people that is going to relate to something in the real world for them? It's very important to understand what's happening. Why?
The introduction to the proposals tells you, but I can't remember how many billions of dollars the forest products industry is, and that we don't know what limits productivity of our forests. Temperate forests have been assumed to be nitrogen limited. Of course, they should be nitrogen limited. They're on young soils, there's plenty of phosphorus in them, not like the tropical ones that are highly weathered and occluded. And it takes a long time to build up nitrogen because it relies on biological nitrogen fixation. So I think part of the reason one of these experiments had never been established is because we thought we knew the answer. Everybody studies nitrogen. I studied phosphorus for my dissertation. So when we started this experiment, we had forests of different ages make part of this experiment, as well as it being at three different sites. So things change depending on what type of forest you're looking at. That's important to understand. So the simulation model said that the older forests should respond more to phosphorus than nitrogen, and the younger ones should respond more to nitrogen. And that's what we got. So I feel like vindicated. Phosphorus is important. this is really basic science.
It is important. And basic science takes such patience. And for you to have this long-term, three different sites and different ages of forests and multi-billion dollar economy surrounding our forest products, but that's in everything everybody should care about. But I'm also interested, are you looking at all in the productivity of the forest in the climate based on the levels of nitrogen and phosphorus?
An important context, and I should have included this in my story, is nitrogen pollution.
Okay.
So one reason you might doubt whether nitrogen is limiting anymore is that we've been dumping air pollution. You know, acid rain is nitric acid and sulfuric acid, and they got plenty of that. So we can ask, are they phosphorus limited now because we
overloaded nitrogen?
We overloaded them with nitrogen, and how long will that last, and what happens as we recover from that? And there's experiments addressing that. Predicting climate change requires a different set of controls that we're not manipulating. So we're mainly learning about nutrients from this study.
Do you have an interdisciplinary team, or are you working with folks in sustainable resources management?
We were already the longest running fertilization experiment in a temperate forest after 3 years. Now it's been 11. My co-PIs in this phase of the research are Tim Fahey at Cornell and Melanie Fisk at Ohio, Miami University. And they've been involved at Hubbard Brook for decades. Prior to that, most of these plots were set up during a calcium study in which the collaborators were Steve Hamburg, who was then at Brown, Joel Bloom, who's a geochemist at Michigan. So it's somewhat interdisciplinary and multi-institutional, but key collaborator from ESF was Tom Horton, who, when we were doing work with mycorrhizae, he was involved.
When did you come here to ESF?
1994.
So you've been here a minute, as my kids would say, right?
Well, I was already involved in this work when I came here. So prior to the calcium study was a series of sites that I'd been working in them when I came here.
I have a lot of questions for you, but I was given a very high level briefing to try to understand what your work is. And it is the document that was probably the most difficult for me to follow of any of the faculty that I have had the benefit of talking to, because it says your work focuses on quantifying uncertainty. What is quantifying uncertainty?
Quantifying the confidence in what we know. How confident are we of this? So scientists are doing that all the time with every statistical test of confidence. How probable is it that this difference arose by chance, and we ascribe a p-value to that,
right?
And then we say, well, if it's really small, then we're very confident, and if it's
really high,
yeah, then we're not so interested.
So what work then are you doing that helps quantify uncertainty? Is that different than what you're describing with the phosphorus and nitrogen fertilization in the forest?
Well, it's important to everything we report that we be first aware and then honest about
what
how confident
know.
Are we. Yeah.
Okay.
That's true for everything. And I think I've been attentive to that my entire career. It's hard to say which came first, because my first assignment, which was to do a phosphorus budget for Hubbard Brook, there was no confidence assigned to the fluxes in any ecosystem nutrient budget. For one thing, because an ecosystem is hard to replicate. One good way to establish confidence is to repeat an experiment many times. You flip a coin many times and you say, okay, I guess I can't really predict whether it's head or tails with very much confidence.
But if you're using a natural setting,
if
it'll be
cutting down
slightly different.
An entire watershed to see how it affects stream chemistry, you can only afford to do that so many times. I heard a prominent scientist give a talk about the global carbon budget and say, there's only one planet, so there's no uncertainty. Say, that's not right. You better propagate the uncertainty in everything you're doing and give us the final answer to how uncertain that number is.
Okay.
If you can't replicate it, then you have to be more creative about how you assemble the pieces to say what's the overall uncertainty in the budget. For example, the first nitrogen budget at Hubbard Brook, which was a feat to, I don't want to undermine it, this was an amazing thing. We know not only how much is coming in the rain and leaving in the streams because of Herb Borman at Hubbard Brook, we're going to add up how much is accumulating in the vegetation. We balance the budget except that 14.2 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year is missing. And that always bugged me. 14.2 plus or minus what? The plus or minus is not too bad until you get to the soil. Just the forest floor alone is plus or minus 22. And if you include the mineral soil, it's plus or minus 57. So how excited are you that we have nitrogen fixation if it's 14 plus or minus 57?
Yeah, it becomes a little less reliable. Is that the right word? Okay.
Yeah. Or so you have to think about it differently.
So you know how much nitrogen is coming in the rain because you've measured it, and you know how much nitrogen is leaving out of the streams after it's landed on the forest, made its way through the root system and down to the water table and made its way to the stream, and you know how much is left, right? And your job then...
And we know how much is going into the trees.
Okay.
And what we can say with confidence is there's more nitrogen coming from somewhere, but it could be coming from the soil. Because every soil pit you dig is different from the other one. So you destroy the whole thing if you tried to get your soil change within 14 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare per year.
So we
know it's coming from somewhere. It's either the atmosphere or the soil. And then you have to be smart about how you would detect whether it's nitrogen fixation or mining of organic nitrogen from the soil.
I can imagine that this is just endlessly interesting for you. To just continue and study this and think about it and try to do it differently. And is it something where, you know, we could test the soils and then run these experiments and then test the soils again too?
Or? There is a major effort, and I'm not involved with it directly, so I'm not going to be able to describe it very well, at Hubbard Brook, not to mention other people working on similar questions around the world, to address this question of the reuse of nitrogen from soils. So what degree is nitrogen or carbon accumulating in soils as a sink? And to what degree is that being released again? Then the hard part for me, and one that I got stuck on from the time I was a grad student until 25 years later, was how do we calculate the uncertainty in the biomass accumulation in the forest? It's easy to have replicate plots. It's not so easy to calculate the uncertainty in how you're calculating the mass and carbon or nutrient content of a tree. You don't cut down all the trees and weigh them and grind them up.
Right.
We have done that to validate these equations. But what you normally do is create an equation describing the relationship between something that's cheap and easy and non-destructive to measure, like the diameter of the tree and maybe its height. And the answer that you want, which is what's the dry weight, what's the carbon content, what's the nutrient concentrations of it. And those are done with log-log regressions that are really nice, but there's a lot of them, especially if you need to account for the leaves and the branches and the bark and the roots and the wood, which all have very different concentrations. So that's why it was such an achievement to create nutrient budgets of this type and why nobody was trying very hard to propagate uncertainty in them.
Wow. So that's what I mean by there's this lifetime of questions that you could be answering, but you've made a lot of progress.
And then because I started publishing in this area with the forest biomass uncertainty, I got invited into carbon accounting of tropical deforestation for climate finance. Mm-hmm. So we pay countries now to reduce their tropical deforestation rates.
Who's we? I did see
that.
Oh,
I'm sorry. We would be the World Bank. There's a lot of programs. The airline industry is saying they're going to offset carbon emissions. What should count as an offset? Are they going to be investing in forest?
So the resources could come from the airlines to pay these countries to limit deforestation.
Comes from your airfare.
Okay. But not yet and only voluntarily, right?
There's also Well, you can now say, yeah, I'll pay extra to do that. But the airline industry is saying it's going to be built into your costs. It's hard for them to fly a plane without burning fossil fuel. So that's an area that's sensitive.
A tougher nut to crack.
Yeah.
Right.
There's also bilateral agreements, Norway, the UK. I'm not the expert on the policy side of this. I'm sorry.
No, it's interesting.
I got brought in because in order to get paid for reducing your deforestation rate or increasing your carbon sequestration rate in afforestation, you have to report not only what your carbon emissions used to be and what they are during this period that you're getting credited for, you have to report the uncertainty in that estimate. There's a lot of politics in it and not just science.
Oh, there sure is a lot of politics, but the politics need the science. And you need people who want to be doing the right thing, and then they need the scientists to explain what are the policies we could be putting in place to mitigate the warming or some of the effects of the climate change.
I want to insert that the biggest uncertainty is not the forest carbon per unit area calculation, which is what I happened to have gotten interested in before I got pulled in. It's how much forest is there. So what they're doing to make these estimates of their carbon emission rates is how much forest is there now, how much was there then, and then you multiply by how much carbon is there in the forest per unit area. And the map accuracy is Steve Stamen's area of expertise.
And do you work with Steve?
Well, Steve Stamen was a friend and a running buddy for 15 years before I got involved in this area. I went to my first meeting of the Red Plus country level carbon uncertainty, and Steve couldn't make it to that meeting, but everybody's talking about Steve Stamen. I was like, you mean my Steve Stamen? I knew that that was what he did, but I didn't ever anticipate that it would become relevant to what I had to offer.
Interesting.
So now we're co-advising three students from Mexico who are being funded partly by the Department of Defense, but State Department, USAID. This is not, I've always been like NSF funding.
Right. So this is a new world for
yeah,
you.
Yeah. So I'm very lucky that Steve is here.
So I also know that you work with high school students, and I'm trying to guess where they might fit into all this work that you're doing.
The biggest carbon and nutrient fluxes in forests are actually the leaf litter and the root turnover. So we have hundreds of litter traps in New Hampshire collecting leaf litter throughout the year. Just drying them and weighing them for carbon would be easy, but we're also interested in how different species are adjusting when we manipulate their nitrogen and phosphorus nutrition. So we're sorting them by species.
So you can see the effects of your experiments in the leaf litter.
We can see if the endomycorrhizal trees are benefiting in response to nitrogen or phosphorus. But in 2 minutes, you can learn to tell a sugar maple from a red maple. And they sit around a table and they're sorting leaves into piles by species.
And are they doing that here on this ESF campus?
They're doing
campus?
It in my lab, yeah.
And so are these local high school students then?
Yeah.
This is great, though, because we want our local high school students to have exposure to an experiment like this. And I am hoping then that they learn the kind of work that's being done here at ESF and the impact they can have. Do you teach undergrads also?
Not now. I taught soils when I came in. I taught forest ecology for a while. So now I'm doing seminars with graduate students.
And those must be interesting, too, because now you're talking to students who have a real clear idea of where they want to go, what they're interested in.
I like project learning. So I teach the required capstone course for our non-thesis master's students, and they have to do a project. And then I teach a course in the spring for students who are preparing manuscripts for publication.
Oh.
And that's all kinds of topics, and that's
And that brings your interest in writing that we started talking about, right? Your interest in writing then gets fed a little bit with that role, I would imagine.
It's an important skill if you want to
Absolutely.
Raise money and communicate your results.
Well, if you listen to some of these older podcasts, we've had people from environmental studies as part of research teams, and they come in and talk about their role in communicating this science out and how important that is. You know, you and I just talked about policymakers needing scientists. Well, they also need scientists who can interpret what that science is and what it could look like in a policy if you're trying to move the needle for the whole society. So I think writing is a skill, no matter what your professional work is. Being a good writer, I think, is valuable to everybody. But I think particularly in this space where all of the faculty are doing this incredible work that has real world application, and then you have people out in the public that I have found generally have good intentions and would like to do the right thing if they knew what the right thing was. I'm sure that's not the case for everybody, but how do you tell people the thing you could be doing in your everyday life that would matter is this thing?
I'm thinking about what people can do and what some of the big lessons are. And in the uncertainty realm, and I think this applies to knowledge of all kinds of things and not just science, trying to identify what you don't understand. Some people aren't comfortable doing that. So modeling that it's okay to do that is helpful.
It's so eloquent the way you just said it, but it's so true that caring would go a long way, especially about things that you don't know.
And that it's okay to ask questions. Sometimes it's even hard to articulate the question. And that's what's keeps me engaged in the uncertainty thing. I'm commonly on the edge. Oh, John Drake now is involved in one of these. And we joke about, am I dumb or am I smart? And you have to be comfortable being dumb enough to say, this is the part I think I don't get. And unless you can identify the part that you think you don't get, you're not going to get it. And so the high school students make a lot of mistakes. It has to be really okay to admit that you made a mistake. We have triple redundancy in, like, we record which sample we're going to do next. We check it off. There's a date. There's notes. It's written on the bag. And then there's still, like, two samples have the same. These can't both be the right one. And we're going to throw them both out if we don't know which one is right. And then there's handwriting. And then there's the day it was processed. And this happens all the time. So I'm hoping that they're learning about being interested in mistakes and how we learn from mistakes, and that if you don't acknowledge a mistake, you're not going to get where you want to be.
Right. You're not going to make progress. Some of the best learning experiences in my life have come from times that I failed at something. I think those are the real learning opportunities. So I have another question for you. So you touched a little bit on the international student part of your life, right? But what we didn't touch on is you also have kept up that international aspect through your teaching. So you've had the ability to be a visiting faculty member at colleges around the world.
Sabbaticals are a wonderful thing. And then I've had two very generous department heads. When I got invitations to Japan, they let me go.
Oh, I think it's such a good learning experience for you and then for the students that you're teaching to have this exposure to somebody from here, and you can describe these experiments that you're talking about. Is that something that you hope to continue to do more of?
I had a certificate of eligibility for a visa for Japan for 2021, so it got postponed. And I need to decide if I'm going to do it or when I'm going to do it.
Does your father still have family in Japan?
My father died a year ago, and his sister died soon after that.
Oh,
so
I'm
that
sorry.
Generation's not there. My sister lives there, and my first cousins are there.
Okay, so
but every time I've lived in Japan before, it was with my father and my daughter. So that was an important part of the. Yeah, my Japanese is not that good. To live there without a personal family translator.
That's a luxury, Ruth. That's a luxury. I lost my dad earlier this year, too. So we're kind of in the same boat. I said, I know it happens to everybody. It's just our time to be going through this. But yeah, especially.
And then, like, are we not going to live forever either?
I know. It starts to feel more real, right? But for you to have this extra reminder of this place that you will be really missing having your father there. So I'm sorry about that, but I do hope you get back. I didn't realize that you had Japanese roots, but of course, Yanai is a very Japanese name, but I just hadn't considered that. Did he grow up in Japan?
Yep.
He did. My in-laws grew up in the Netherlands and came here on their wedding day. So I'm married to a first generation American. And, you know, some of the stereotypes are true. They're really awesome people, work hard. You know, they came here with a purpose, and I'm the beneficiary of that. And I'm sure that the people in your life feel the same way with you being this first generation American. It's a different perspective, isn't it?
Yeah. Shall we talk about race?
Okay, good. Yes. Yes.
I don't know how much of this will be relevant. Perceptions of race in our culture have changed a lot over my lifetime, and I think are changing increasingly rapidly. One of the things I found cleaning up my father's apartment was an essay that my mother wrote the 2 years that they lived in Japan when I was already an adult. He started out as an analytical chemist working for Roman Haas, which in Bristol, PA, which is why I grew up across the river from that, and got into plastics. And then Japan became an important trading partner. We're buying their cars, they should be using our plastics. So he was either jet lagged or away from home. He was responsible for marketing Roman Haas plastics in all of Asia, and my mother agreed to live in Japan for 2 years. When I was cleaning out my father's apartment, I found this essay that my mother wrote. It was published in the Foreign Wives of Japanese journal. So she was a foreign wife of Japanese. And she wrote about race, being married to a Japanese in the U.S.
How interesting to see your mother's writing about her perspective.
Well, and it ended up being she wrote this in the 1980s, and I wasn't aware of it at the time. What she said was that my younger sister grew up very conscious of race, and I was oblivious.
Do you think the time was different?
Well,
or the personalities?
Yeah. So one thing she said about it was the first time we visited Japan and the first time my father had been back to Japan in 17 years, my sister was in first grade and I was in third. So she missed the first month of school. When she came back, her classmates thought of her as Japanese. Every week for show and tell, she brought something from Japan. So it could be that she was younger, and it could be that other people perceived her that way. I was kind of unaware. I'm kind of not very self-conscious to begin with, so that could be personality. At my 20th or 30th high school reunion, someone who took a picture of me and a African-American classmate said in the caption on
Facebook or something,
yeah, that I was the only Asian in our class. And I was completely unaware that I was the only Asian.
That says a lot, though. I think that's very interesting. I mean, and you were very close in time to Asia.
And it was part of my family identity, but it wasn't a class identity, because right. We were the only Asian family in town. So who do you identify with? I think it would have been different if there were 10 of us on the playground and the white kids played together and the Asian kids played together. My identity would be different in that case.
Right. But you didn't have any school identity wrapped up in race.
Right.
It was just one of the kids.
Right. So when I first came to ESF, I don't know why I was recruited along with Russ Briggs out of one search for a soils professor. Phil Krall retired and Ed White moved into Dean of Research. So there were two openings and they hired both of us. You know, was I the diversity hire? So they get to count me as a woman and as an Asian. And I used to think, that's cheating. Like, how Asian am I? Do I sound Asian? Do I act Asian? The first time an Asian female graduate student told me that I was an important role model for her. And it was because I don't act Asian. She didn't say it's because you don't act Asian. What she said is, we're not supposed to speak up.
Interesting. Huh.
And I modeled an alternative for her because I was raised
differently.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think that's so interesting. And the more diversity, the better. Anywhere you are in any group, I think it's a healthier, stronger, bodes better for the future group, the more diverse that it is. But when we talk about it today in 2022, it's that lived experience that we're trying to diversify. And your lived experience isn't a lot different than mine, you know? So it shouldn't really count as the diversity hire, but who knows, right?
I was also, I didn't realize I was a girl. Not in the terms of gender identification.
I would say the same thing. Like, I was a real tomboy growing up, and I was not limited at all. I was raised by parents who were, you can be anything you want to be, you know, go do that, you know? And so I'm a lawyer by education. I never felt limited by my gender at all until there came a point in my political career when I got a job kind of over the will of the party. And you really saw that undertone come out. And I thought, oh, I was fine as long as I was doing whatever he wanted me to do. But once I stepped kind of too far into the world that they didn't think
he
I belonged.
Said you can't do that 'cause you're a girl.
Wow. And, you know, good thing for me, I was in my 40s before I ever saw it. And I said, I feel like I have to go back to the women that are a little older than me because they always celebrated the fact that, you know, you're the first woman to do this or. And I always kind of poo-pooed it, you know, because like you, I never identified that way.
I didn't know there were barriers.
Yeah. But now I said, I feel like I have to go back and apologize because I was really wrong. The world is not quite all the way to equal yet. And I do appreciate the work of the women who came ahead to try to level that playing field. But I thought the fight was over until then I realized, oh, no, it's not completely over. And once my eyes were opened, I suppose I was a little less naive about it. But I had this blissful, you know, not affiliated with kind of any group. I could do anything I wanted to do. And I feel like I'm better for it. But it's interesting that you have that perspective now looking at a Facebook post all those years later and someone has to tell you, Ruth, you were the only Asian girl in our class.
The female experience was, this is before Zoom. The first job I had out of my PhD was at the Boyce Thompson Institute for Plant Research at Cornell. And every Monday morning, there were two scientists who would each give half an hour on their research. And if you couldn't make it, you could get the video of it. So I gave one, and then I said, I want to see it. I want to see the DVD. That was when I saw that I was a girl. Like, I don't look like all the guys who've been standing up there giving a talk for half an hour every Monday morning. I don't
Is that
move
interesting?
The same or I don't, yeah, look the same as
and
them.
And, you know,
there weren't any other women for me to compare myself to, just like there weren't any Japanese kids on the playground.
So you've had such an interesting experience. I feel the same way. I've been around, I've had careers. I was an assistant DA, heavily dominated by men, you know, in the office. And then being in the particular political realm that I was in, kind of the same. So I never did. I never really, I mean, you can kind of tell by looking at us, right? We're not all adorned and, you know, competing with women because we just weren't really cognizant of all of that. And I think we're better off for it, but it probably mattered to both of us in ways that we're just still learning. I think it's other people's perceptions that were a lot more important in those stories than how we felt. So before we go, what's next for you? Like, what's keeping you excited about the work that you're doing?
One of my recurring topics of interest now is, what does retirement look like? Because I'm very excited about what I'm doing. I don't know how to stop it. How do you stop an experiment that's already the longest running? I hope I find successors who want to keep it going. I enjoy it. I don't have any reason to stop, but I'm 64. You know, like, are we going to live forever? And is there something else I want to do with my life? Right. So it keeps me going. It all keeps me going. There's nothing I'd rather be doing.
Well, that says it all. The fact that you've had the career that you have and you're still saying that you love what you're doing and that's, you know, what you want to be doing, that pretty much will define retirement. Good for you. I say you win the game of life if you feel that way. You know, do you have family in other parts of the world, though, that you'd like to be a little more flexible about seeing?
My daughter turned 25, so it's not
Happy
obvious
birthday.
Where she's going to end up, and that would affect where I want to be.
I don't want to rush my life, but I am looking forward to those days, you know. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, getting to know you a little better, and understanding now what was written on the paper in front of me about the work that you're doing. But thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to sit and talk to us. And I wish you well in whatever the future holds for you. But we will see you and enjoy having you here at ESF.
I learned some new things about you, but also some new things about me. Thanks very much.